yesterday we did Gauss-Kadazy, which was, you know, again, quite a mathematical formalism, although we'd sort of had a motivation for looking at it, which was to look at the gravitational action. So I thought today we could actually think about what situations these submanifolds arise in. Now, obviously, because a submanifold is infinitesimally thin, it's got a lower dimension than our space-time manifold, that means that that's not sort of physical, except as an approximation to something. So in reality, what we're looking at are things that are effectively lower dimensional. So something that is thin in some sense compared to the sort of other scales on which it is sort of characterized. And so I'm going to, you know, say a few general things, but then I want to look at a very specific example, which is which I'm going to do via a toy model. And that example is going to be a domain wall. So, you know, a domain wall is basically something where you have different choices of ground energy states. So the obvious one is domain walls in ferromagnets. But it's something that seems, you know, these sort of effectively lower dimensional submanifolds arise in one form or another, sort of quite generally in physics. And what we're going to be looking at is their gravitational properties. So let's write some of that down. So here's our picture for describing some sort of physical objects. I've shown it here as a string just to illustrate the fact that, you know, we don't have to have a particular dimensionality or codimensionality of an object. And the basic idea is there is a scale which is the width of the object, and the other scale is the sort of scale of the embedding, which we represent by the extrinsic curvature. And so the idea is that that is much bigger than the width. So that's, if we have that set up, then we can effectively describe a physical object as being lower dimensional. And so typically, these are referred to as brains. And what I want to do is just to explore what can happen gravitationally in the context of some toy models. So this is, I guess what I'm going to talk about today is uses sort of various different aspects of different techniques that we commonly use in gravity when we're trying to find solutions. And when we find exact solutions, because gravity is highly nonlinear, we usually have to make some sort of approximation. We have to compromise in some way or another, either by making things very symmetric. So we saw that when we solved for the spherically symmetric static metric and got the Schwarzschild solution. Sometimes we look where we have a known background and we perturb around it. So that's perturbation theory. And what I want to do today is a sort of prescription which is linearized gravity. It's not quite the same as perturbation theory, but it's where you have a situation where you've got matter sources, but they're not at Planck scale. So you kind of do a step-by-step procedure to find the gravitational field. You find what your matter sources are on flat background. You use that energy momentum to find a gravitational back reaction. And if you want to, you can use the back reacted space-time to find a new corrected solution, and so on and so forth. So it's saying that you're solving nonlinear differential equations, but there's some expansion parameter, so you solve them order by order. It's the idea. So we'll see that in the context of a domain wall. And this is going to be a co-dimension one submanifold. Or effectively a co-dimension one submanifold. So this is our picture. We have a normal N. We have a normal coordinate Z. So we choose coordinates. This is what I was doing yesterday in Gauss-Kadatze. We're choosing coordinates such that we have a single coordinate that's very simple, z. Z is the proper distance from the wall. We find it by integrating along the normal to the wall. So remember, the distance of a point from a plane or a surface is always along the normal direction. So that's the idea. And, of course, this is going to be well-defined as long as we're always within a radius of curvature of the wall. So our metric, which we'll come back to later, is going to look something like the following. We have a set of coordinates. I'm calling them y rather than sigma this time. A set of coordinates intrinsic to our submanifold. So these are the y's. And a metric intrinsic to the submanifold. And I'm going to sort of presume that this gamma depends on the y's. And then potentially we have a function, a of z, that says the distances within, sort of parallel to our wall, if we move away from it, might change. So our toy model is going to be a field theory with a real scalar field. With a double well potential. So this is your sort of classic toy potential when you're exploring spontaneous symmetry breaking. So here we have two vacua for our field theory sitting at plus and minus eta. So when you probably met this in quantum field theory, and when you met it there, you would have chosen a vacuum, either plus or minus, and then you would have quantized around the vacuum and looked at fluctuations around phi equals eta, say, and you'd have found that what you had was a massive scalar field. And so the mass of the scalar field would be set by the symmetry breaking scale, this eta, and the coupling. So that's what you would get from if you were just doing this from a field theory perspective. But we're thinking about this more from a gravitational perspective, so we're interested in anything interesting that can happen that's not necessarily about quantum field theory, not about perturbation theory. So we're looking for non-perturbative effects here, and in particular, can we have something that has a localized energy density on this wall? So our equation of motion we get by varying with respect to phi. So that's just the wave operator of phi now equaling the derivative of the potential with respect to phi. So that's our wave equation. And I want to just first step back from gravity and just explore how we get a non-perturbative solution. So we're going to look for a solution that depends only on that normal direction. And that interpolates between the two different vacua. So as z goes off to the left to minus infinity, I'm going to say my field goes off to the left vacuum, phi equals minus eta. As z goes off to plus infinity, I'm going to say phi goes to the plus vacuum, z equals plus eta. So then that means our equation of motion becomes phi double primed is 2 lambda phi, phi squared minus eta squared. And that is solved by a tanh function. So here our tanh, we take the derivative, get sec squared. So you see that this becomes sec squared is just 1 minus tanh squared, and so you can manipulate that back to the equation of motion. So that does what we want it to do. We have, this is our zero, we have a profile of phi, as a function of z. So it satisfies what we want. Phi goes to the left vacuum as z goes to minus infinity. Phi goes to the right vacuum as z goes to plus infinity. And in the middle, it's got an interpolation with a width of order 1 over root lambda eta. This is known as the kink. Now, it's actually a stable solution to the field theory, because if we were to try and turn that solution into one vacuum or the other, we would have to lift our field over the potential barrier over an infinite volume of space. So we can't just turn that into phi as plus eta or phi equals minus eta without an infinite cost in energy. So it is actually an alternative vacuum, if you like, around which you can quantize, but it's just not the true vacuum. It's It's a non-trivial vacuum. So if we ask, you know, I say this interpolation is localized, we ask what its energy is. So our energy momentum tensor, we found that when we were looking at our gravitational action. So the only difference now is that we've got an interacting field, so we have a V sitting in our energy momentum tensor. Well, the only thing phi depends on is Z. So we have that's a half phi prime squared in there. So our energy momentum tensor is actually quite relatively simple. And then if we look at what our phi prime squared is, we see phi prime squared is this such to the fourth. Have this sort of quite interesting coincidence that the gradient energy is related to the potential energy. And so, in essence, this we find our energy momentum tensor is actually rather simple. Our metric is just flat, eta mu nu, and this phi prime squared here, this half phi prime squared gives me another V. So that's 2V G mu nu. And this is 2V delta Z mu Z nu. But of course, this is just the components of the normal to Z equals zero. And so our energy momentum tensor is just equal to the first fundamental, or proportional to the first fundamental form. Now, V is proportional to such to the fourth. So if I sketch V, it's sharply peaked around Z0. And so what we're seeing is that we have an energy momentum tensor very sharply localized. And the energy momentum tensor just has parallel components to the brain in this case. So this is sort of our typical signature of one of these sort of localized submanifolds, that what it should be very thin, and the dominant parts of the energy momentum should be parallel to the submanifold. So it really is lower dimensional, sort of very strongly a lower dimensional object. So if we ask what is its energy, all I'm doing is integrating my such function, such to the fourth function, in Z, and that just gives me essentially the width of the wall times that lambda eta to the fourth. So I get a sort of factor times root lambda eta cubed. So my object has finite energy per unit area, but of course it's got infinite area. So that's the background solution. That's sort of telling us that if we have a field theory that has a non-trivial vacuum structure, then we can get interesting objects which interpolate between the different vacua. So in this case, we have a Z2 symmetric theory, but it's a spontaneously broken theory because we have two distinct vacua. However, if we want to not just do perturbation theory, but think about what non-trivial possible solutions there are, we interpolate from one vacuum to the other, and that gives us one of these domain walls. So that's interesting anyway from a perspective of, you know, looking at more exotic backgrounds for your field theory. But from a gravitational perspective, it's also given us an interesting puzzle, because this object could potentially have formed in the early universe, let's say, if there was a phase transition where you had a choice of different vacua. And if it did, then although it's got a finite energy per unit area, it's got an infinite area. So what happens gravitationally? We sort of feel that something having an infinite total energy ought to be bad news from a gravitational perspective. So what we'll now do is to try and find what the gravitational field is. So I wrote down, when I was sketching the domain wall, I wrote down what we might expect the metric to be. Now, at some level, I'd already kind of, you know, jumped ahead of the game by assuming it had this sort of general form. But now that we've got an energy momentum tensor here that is a profile in the z direction times something that really is intrinsic to the surface, that kind of backs up what I wrote down here. So this looks a reasonable ansatz to take for the metric. So what I'll do now is I'll find the curvature tensor of that, and then we'll talk about the solution for A of Z and for gamma. So in terms of finding the curvature tensor, we'll do that Cartan trick again, Cartan method. So in terms, I have to find an orthonormal basis. So here I'm going to hat the indices because I've tried to be consistent with the notation I used with Gauss-Kodazzi, in which case I need capital letters for my submanifold indices. And so I need to distinguish whether they are the index of the basis or a coordinate index. So the hats are the index of the orthonormal basis. So here I'm making no assumptions about the form of gamma AB. So this is an orthonormal basis for gamma AB dyA dyB. So I'm not going to delve into what gamma AB is. I'm just leaving that at the moment completely general. This is where you'll sort of see how useful or how powerful, if you like, this Cartan method can be. So I need the connection, so I just differentiate my forms. When I differ, the only one that has a non-zero value is the derivative of omega A. I first differentiate the A of Z. That gives me an omega Z cross omega A. That should be a hat, not a primed And then when I differentiate omega naught, I just use the Cartan expression, d omega naught is minus theta wedge omega naught. So notice this here will be in terms of omega naught, okay? So that A combines with this omega naught to give me an omega. And so I can read off my connection. That's what I wanted to do. So now I want to calculate curvature. So let me start with the AB components. I've just written down Cartan's second equation, inputting what my theta AB is. So the first bit, this bit here, is obviously just R naught AB, remembering that it's in terms of the omega naughts. And then the second piece is obviously going to be an a primed on a squared. And then let me just look at what I get. So theta az is omega a. But theta zb, to get the indices in this order, I have to take theta bz, I have to lower my b index with an eta, I have to swap the order of the indices, which gives me one minus sign. And then I have to raise the z-index, which gives me a second minus sign. So this is omega a hat cross omega b hat, where omega b hat, put it in a different color, is just where I've lowered that index with the orthonormal Minkowski metric. So that's my RAB. So that's my curvature 2 form in the AZ direction. So then if I look at what theta AZ is just A prime times omega naught A. So that's A double primed DZ cross omega naught A hat. And then I've got plus A primed, minus a primed theta naught ab cross omega b. And then I've got a plus a theta naught ac cross a primed omega naught c. So you can see that these two terms here are the same, but one is a, now I've got obviously, oh yeah, one is with a minus sign and one is with a plus sign. So those two cancel. And so all I'm left with is a double primed on A, omega Z cross omega A. Right, so that's calculated the curvature tensor. And so all I need to do is pull off the individual components. And so I simply get, that's my Riemann tensor. So it really wasn't that bad. And it's sort of, you know, with just a couple of lines and a small amount of work, I've calculated a Riemann tensor of quite a general looking metric. So this gives me my Ricci tensor in a coordinate basis now. So if we just assumed our manifold had a general dimension D, so we've got a D minus one dimensional submanifold, the useful thing about having done it this way is I can do this now for an arbitrary dimension. So when I find my Ricci tensor, I'm just contracting here on A and C. So you can see you get something that's proportional to R naught, so that's this piece here. Then I've got some A primed on A squared terms, so that's where contracting this on the D minus one manifold gives me a factor of D minus two. And then of course I've got the A double primed on A from here. Then if my RZZ is just the contraction of this, which is D minus one, A double primed on A. So in our case, we've got D is 4. Let's just stick to something in our space-time. So we have D is 4. Moreover, our energy momentum tensor is completely homogeneous and isotropic in the brain, in the parallel directions to the brain. So it doesn't pick out any specific direction. So that suggests to us that what we have in gamma is a constant curvature space, something that doesn't pick out a specific direction. And so the constant curvature spaces are the flat space-time manifold, a sphere, something positively curved, and the hyperboloid, something negatively curved. So I'm going to take the curvature of gamma to be set by kappa over L squared. So the Ricci tensor is going to be set by kappa over L squared. So if I restrict to D equals 4 and find my Einstein tensor, this is what I get. I don't need to do all the other, all the other directions in Y. I'm just going to look at the time-like direction because they're all the same. It's constant curvature space. So that's my Einstein tensor, and this should be equal to my energy momentum tensor. And then I'm writing down my curved space equation for the phi field. So these are my fully general gravity plus scalar equations, assuming phi is just a function of the z direction.
What's L?
Sorry?
What's L?
So L is the curvature. So for example, if we had, e.g. if kappa were 1, and gamma were Euclidean, which it isn't, but anyway. Then gamma AB would be the metric on an SD minus 1 with radius L. So L is like the curvature. We'll see this actually when we find our solution. So the Ricci scalar of a sphere is proportional to 1 and L squared, and the constant of proportionality is just dimension. It's a factor dependent on dimension. So kappa is telling you you've got curvature. If it's not 0, kappa is 1. Is positive curvature, kappa is 0 is flat, kappa is minus 1 is negative curvature. So actually, did this not crop up on your homework with Cartan and Frieden Robertson Walker, maybe? Universe? And you'll see it in cosmology as well.
So. How do you get kappa from the previous stuff we've done?
So kappa is an input. So here, I'm just saying that because my energy momentum tensor is featureless, it's suggesting to me that the space parallel to the brain is a constant curvature space. So when you start with cosmology, you have a very similar setup. You assume in that case, your energy momentum tensor is something with an energy density and an isotropic pressure. So from the perspective of the spatial sections of the universe, it's featureless. It's homogeneous and isotropic. And once you've got a space that's homogeneous and isotropic, it's constant curvature. So we haven't necessarily said we've got full homogeneity and isotropy here, we're kind of taking that from the form of the energy momentum tensor. We're saying this is physically reasonable. With the universe, we actually have more to go on because we've got observations that tell us that this looks to be the case. Here we're saying this looks like a reasonable thing to do, so let's do it. So in general, this is a system of coupled, nonlinear, there and there, differential equations. So it's not, to find an analytic solution, unless you cook a potential very carefully, which i.e. not this one, you don't have a closed analytic solution. But it's easy enough to pop it on a computer and just integrate them up to find an exact solution for your phi and your gravitational field A. What we can do, though, analytically, and it's always good to do things analytically so you get a feel for what the behavior of a system is in certain limits, what we can do analytically is to say, well, suppose, and I'm about to make this precise, suppose these expressions here are small, again, I'm going to make that precise, so that it's a good approximation, this A primed on A, which is being set by 8 pi g times the energy momentum tensor, this term is much smaller than the phi double primed and the gradient of the potential. If that is the case, then what I can do is I can use the background solution that I derived previously to find my solution for phi to leading order. I plug that into the right-hand side of the Einstein equations. That's my energy source. I find the gravitational back reaction due to that background solution. That then gives me an A. And if I want, I can go back and correct my phi and find a better approximation. And then better phi, I go back, find better A. And hopefully that process converges to finding what you would have if you just put it on the computer in the first place. So that's called a sort of linearization of gravity. And so let's see how that works. Let me make what I said about things being small precise. So let's estimate this back reaction. So my background solution had TZZ being zero, and the energy density was proportional to this Sech function. Now, the Z naught, I put that in to make my solution completely general, but it's obviously not, it's not sort of a physically important parameter. It's just something that's representing a translation invariance of the solution. So I'm going to set Z naught to naught. Now I'm going to try and define some parameters that tell me about the order of magnitude of my gravitational sort of effects. So I'm going to define a parameter epsilon, which is 8 pi g eta squared. And so this is basically eta over mp squared. So mp is the Planck mass. So mp squared is 1 over 8 pi g. And so this is saying that if my symmetry breaking scale is, you know, comfortably below the Planck scale, then this is going to tell me the gravitational impact of my solution is small. So this is much less than 1. So this is, in some sense, a weak field. So my 8 pi g t naught naught is then epsilon times a lambda eta squared times this Sech to the fourth function. So here, this is like my localization. So it's like a delta of z. That's telling me I've got something thin. This, which is m phi squared, is really setting a scale. And so here is my order epsilon, which is giving me this is actually giving me my gravitational strength. So I want to just try and make things easy. So I'm going to set z hat is root lambda eta z. And this is, if you like, choosing units that are sort of natural from the field perspective. So this is like field units. In other words, in these units, the mass of the scalar is of order 1, and the width of the wall is of order 1. So here, A of z hat double primed, so we're now differentiating with respect to z hat, this is going to be 1 over lambda eta squared, d squared a by dz squared. And if we look over here, tzz is roughly 0, so that tells me this is roughly 0, so that tells me a primed on a squared is kappa on a squared. So these two terms, you can see this is the same as that there. So my a double primed on a is just 4 pi g times, 8 pi g t naught naught. So here, what I said was 8 pi g t naught naught was order epsilon times this lambda eta squared times the sech to the fourth. So what that is telling me is that I've taken out my spurious factors of lambda and eta, which are really just setting a scale. And it's telling me that the real parameter in this that's governing what's happening is the epsilon parameter. That's the gravitational strength of the wall. And so if epsilon is small, A primed is corrected to order epsilon. And therefore, I've confirmed that in this equation of motion for phi, that any corrections coming from A primed on A are of order epsilon. So it's okay for me to take the tanh as leading order and then find the order epsilon corrections. So our technique, which is sort of linearization, is that we solve in background. Imagine it for flat space. We find T mu nu, calculate gravitational back reaction, and then an important step, check how consistent this is. Always important. So the reason that we need to do that last step is, of course, that although locally the impact of our energy momentum is small, we've got an infinite area. So we do have to be sure that infinity times a small number is still infinity. So why we have to be careful. Right, so here, if we integrate up our A double primed equation, we get this profile. So that's integrating up such to the fourth. So that's our A primed. Now, here, kappa on L squared is a constant. And a prime squared is not quite a constant. However, notice that the GZZ equation, this is order epsilon squared, because it's a prime squared. And so this is order, this right-hand side would be order epsilon, except the V cancels the phi prime. So the right-hand side is also order epsilon squared. So we can't precisely calculate or integrate that GZZ equation because it's order epsilon squared. However, if we go outside the wall, what we do expect is that TZZ will vanish, whether or not phi has been corrected. So if I look outside the wall, that's where z hat is large, tanh is 1 plus or minus 1. So a prime squared is epsilon squared times 2 thirds squared. So here I've got 2 thirds epsilon squared should equal kappa over L squared. So that tells me that kappa is 1, as I was sort of already hinting, and that epsilon there should be a lambda eta squared here, because this, sorry, that equation over there is written in z and not z hat. So makes it dimensionally correct. So let me just finish off by integrating up for A. So notice that a prime goes to a constant on each side. So what that means is that although a is order epsilon in some sense, as we get to very large z, our correction does not necessarily remain small. And so while we are consistent in terms of our expansion procedure, we have a problem, potentially, as z goes to L. So as z goes to L, our metric, so let's sort of look at positive z, outside, well, let's call it outside the wall. this is what our metric looks like. The thing in square brackets is the constant curvature space. So that really does look, well, first of all, it doesn't look, it looks quite, you know, non-trivial. It also seems to have something that's a bit like a horizon as Z goes to L. But we know that outside the wall, we're in vacuum. And because our space has so much symmetry, if we kind of look at our, where are we? At the top. If we look at our Riemann tensor, we've got A double primed on A, that's zero outside the wall. And in the purely brain directions, we've got a sort of kappa, our constant curvature piece, one on L squared, and an A prime squared. And we just saw that A prime squared cancelled one on L squared. So it looks like those Riemann components vanish outside the wall. So if I do this, then I've picked my rho coordinate to be the coordinate that's multiplying d omega 2 squared. And in fact, what I've managed to do is I've done a coordinate transformation that turns that metric into flat space. So this is confirming that away from the wall, we have flat space-time. So what's going on? So if we have, look for z equals constant surfaces, we see that those are hyperbole in the rho tau space. And t equals constant says rho is proportional to tau. So if I sketch that, that means that I have t equals constant and z equals constant. This is very familiar. This looked like what we had in Kruskal diagrams. So it's very like an event horizon. And so what we see is that if I sketch my surface of the center of the wall, I have a hyperboloid in my rho tau space, in my flat space. And inside, I've got positive z. And so z, as z goes to L, I'm hitting this light cone. So I have a light cone in the middle, which is my so-called horizon. It's just a causal horizon. I've got the same picture for z less than naught. And so what I have, for example, if I take tau equals zero, I have that rho runs from naught to roughly L for both sides, for Z positive and Z negative. So I have two copies of a hyperboloid glued together. And my space is compact, and it's topologically a sphere. So what's happened is gravity has actually spontaneously regularized the system. If I looked in flat space, my wall had infinite area, and so it would have infinite mass. Instead, gravitationally what's happened is the space is compactified, so my wall now has a finite area. It's just the area of this equatorial sphere here, which is of size L. So gravitationally, I've regularized my system. It's now got a finite size, so there's no singularity or infinities as far as gravity is concerned. But globally, my space-time is very different. It's now compact. It has this slightly bizarre structure. But that is indeed what it is. So we can, this is sort of an example of how gravity can be mild, linearized locally, but nonetheless globally have a very strong effect. So in terms of our linearization prescription, we've actually, this picture that I've drawn there now is indeed a sort of consistent procedure, finding solutions in order epsilon. They look approximately like this. This is our leading order solution. And then when you correct, you'll find sort of a much better description across the center of the wall, but the whole sort of structure or the whole picture of the space-time won't change. Right, run over again.